What do emerging technologies look like to those outside of the first world? While we here in the United States are obsessed with AI, agog over mixed realities, cheekily experimenting with our voice assistants, people in other parts of the world have far less access to the latest technology and use their technology in very different ways from us. In order to better understand the world beyond the comfort of our standing desks and task chairs, we welcome Payal Arora to the show. Payal is the author of 2019 book, The Next Billion Users from Harvard University Press, and is an associate professor of media and communication at Erasmus University Rotterdam. My name is Dirk Niemeyer, a social futurist interested in systems that will make the quality of our lives better. My partner is Jonathan Follett, a writer, composer, and emerging tech researcher. Welcome to Season 2, Episode 11 of Creative Next, a show about future-proofing creatives in a world of AI automation. Let's get started. This show is about the future. It's a future that we have some insight into, in part because we are preparing to live in it. This future of smartware, of AI and augmentation and automation, these are things we expect to experience and hope to play some small role in helping to guide. But as much as we see ourselves and people like you as participants in this future, it is easy to forget that the future for a majority of our fellow Earthlings will look far different. Most do not come from wealthy countries. They do not have university educations. They do not have conspicuous abundances of food, possessions, living spaces, and affluent communities. Their reality is different. It is a reality we have somewhere between no and woefully inadequate insight into. While it is in some ways outside of our editorial purview, our show is about this more privileged future whose trajectory you and we share. We need to be aware of it. The world continues to get smaller. To remain exclusively within our little bubble will ultimately, sooner or later, stunt the very innovation we hope to benefit from. We need to understand, from a social, technological, and merely human perspective, how others with whom we share this world are experiencing it. How those things are similar to or different than our own experiences, and how we and they can perhaps inform and benefit one another. Even if we're not moved to do it for the greater good, at a minimum, this broader perspective will ultimately benefit you. So it is that we are pleased to welcome Payal Arora to Creative Next. She is the author of The Next Billion Users and an associate professor in the Department of Media and Communication at Erasmus University Rotterdam. Her research has taken her around the world, becoming deeply immersed in a variety of diverse and important cultures. Let's learn about how different cultures are using the latest technologies, starting with India.
I recognize that it becomes even more urgent, particularly in contexts like India, which I found where arranged marriages are the norm. So over the decade, one thing that kept coming up again and again is that young people are very enthusiastic about taking on digital media because they're dying to have a little experience of romance, love, get an online boyfriend or girlfriend, and just claim that they have had certain kind of experience. Because think about it. I mean, these are, for the most part, young people who need to self-actualize but are in deeply conservative and constrained settings. And so, of course, they are going to seek this out even more so than we would. And I have seen them use digital media in ways which are extraordinarily creative and, you know, typical teenage sort of circumvention from their all-seeing eyes of their parents, their communities, so they could, well, chat up a girl or a boy. They're very trusting. They're absolutely enthusiastic about digital media. If you listen to the kind of conversations, even amongst young people in Europe or the US, there's a lot of concern, rising sort of concern about their privacy and about how to curate themselves. And with young people in India, there is just high optimism about these digital media platforms because it really allows them to express themselves in ways that they have not had the chance to. But also they are very optimistic about entertainment. it comes from Bollywood, which is the biggest film industry, and latched onto it the whole music industry, right? Bollywood songs. And so a lot of their lives are spent, you know, being stuck in traffic for hours or standing in line and very, very absolutely mundane jobs. And so this gives them a sort of a coping mechanism. I think what's really interestingly distinct is WhatsApp, because now the internet for a vast majority of these populations, particularly India, is being lived on WhatsApp, which is encrypted platforms behind these walls, which makes it very hard for people like us, researchers, or anyone who's trying to see what's going on, to understand what these digital lives are, unless you actually join them. And our elections in India has just been happening. And so, in fact, what they have been noticing is if you want to win an election in India or any of these developing countries, you need to win the WhatsApp war, information war, because it's extremely difficult to see what's going on behind them. It's even hard to even keep track of how many WhatsApp groups. There could be hundreds of thousands of political WhatsApp groups that can be circulating all kinds of messages. And so this, I would say, is our future challenge of almost like an aversion to automation and AI, because if you can't get to this information, how are you supposed to compute it?
In fact, India is the largest market for WhatsApp in the world, with an estimated more than 300 million users, or about the population of the United States. That's a whole lot of people using this humble little messaging app in one place. Pyle's framing of the culture is grim. Deeply conservative and strained settings. Absolutely mundane jobs. Coping mechanism. It really makes me appreciate the comparative liberalism in the United States. I feel empathy for Indian children who will generally have less freedom to self-actualize than my own kids. Basic self-actualization should be a universal right. But there's something else important here. There is a large population of young, repressed digital natives who are using technology to subvert a repressive culture. While in these examples from Pyle that is merely manifesting in everyday things like dating and socializing, you have a huge number of people with shared tech competence and platforms who could be the basis for larger social change if the conditions should warrant it. What are Pyle's observations about China?
China is fascinating because if you look at what's going on right now. And what has really preoccupied the media discourse is its social credit score system. And that's basically this idea that each person gets a sort of a personal score, a sort of a rating system based on their online behavior, their background information, their payment systems, have they paid their fines on time? You know, and basically all these different data sets coming together into this one mega data set, calling yourself a digital identity. If you Google, you know, that you just see nonstop Orwellian discourses about how this is very much like the Black Mirror of, you know, if one has watched that, of this, that you are basically being trapped by this one digital identity and you're going to be constantly watched and deeply manipulated. However, in reality, there are different kinds of China. And what I mean by that is that different groups of people in China are experiencing the internet in different ways. And that has to be recognized because the fact is that the average urban Chinese, say particularly the Han, have profited a lot because they have much easier governance mechanisms. They can access money in ways which are so much more seamless. The fintech, it's not a surprise that China is leading in fintech in the world. And the fact is that China, in the shortest amount of time, has brought a significant number of people out of poverty. And that is no small feat. There's definitely pros and cons, and we've got to see this in a balanced narrative rather than throwing the baby with the bathwater. And indeed, it is an authoritarian state among certain populations, but not among the others. And we need to be able to see these differences so we can focus and target our energies in the right directions.
Pyle is right that the social credit scheme is Orwellian. Currently, it exists in a somewhat ad hoc way for a minority of Chinese citizens and is often run on a local level. but it is set to be centralized and rolled out universally to everyone in China. In an article by Alexandra Ma for Business Insider, consequences of low scores or prohibited behavior could include being banned from the use of macro transportation, such as flights and trains, throttling internet speeds, preventing your children from attending school, being blacklisted from prestige jobs such as state-owned organizations and big financial institutions, being banned from better hotels, having your pet confiscated, and being publicly named as a bad citizen. This system is so extreme that the ramifications won't be fully understood until it is in practice. It certainly further contrasts China with the West. Even as we are in the midst of the far-right political parties gaining momentum, they remain a minority. The state authoritarianism on display in China is at odds with the social liberalism that has blossomed in the West in the decades after World War II. The impact of these policies on people in China, and on China as what should eventually become the world's most powerful nation, is an essential trend to watch. Let's move on to South Africa.
I was in Cape Town at the time when Cape Town could have been the first city in the world to have run out of water. And so you'd wonder, okay, what's the connection with the digital media? Now, here is where public accountability started to play out, because they started to come up with a quota system of how much water each household could consume, which obviously meant clearly you cannot have swimming pools. But because of GPS technologies, they started to show these sort of neo-apartheid systems, because even though apartheid got over in the 90s, it seems that particularly white middle-class populations continued with their swimming pools, seemed to exploit these sort of measures, while the townships, where majority of them being black populations, were living with very little meager access to water. So this sort of digital aggregations of information pushed people to protest and pushed for stronger enforcements of these regulations, which wouldn't have happened without these technologies. But driving through South Africa is a really stark reminder how apartheid is still very much present, in the sense of you see Cape Town and Stellenbosch, particularly Stellenbosch, which is the archetype, which is completely Europeanized and so wide and so prosperous. And you have the wine county, which, by the way, takes on so much water. And it was thriving. Nobody seemed to have even adjusted their lifestyle at all in any little way. And yet you knew there was an ongoing crisis. There was literally a countdown. Like, there was a clock everywhere in public spaces showing how many days were left.
This is especially interesting in the context of that water crisis in South Africa, but is actually a more universal phenomenon. Research at UC Berkeley in the United States revealed that people of higher socioeconomic status were more likely to break traffic rules, cheat to win a prize, take candy from children, and pocket extra change they received in error rather than returning it. The researchers concluded that wealthy people are less reliant on social bonds for survival, so they are more willing to ignore rules. The more wealth disparity there is in a society, the more apparent these advantages are. Anyway, this sociological insight notwithstanding, it was interesting to hear that the inequities of apartheid are still very present in South Africa. This experience led Pyle to get smarter about water consumption.
And so you really get frustrated and, of course, actually deeply angry about these sort of amazing inequalities. But also, I think what was interesting was the strategies one uses, because actually after that, I came back and I started to be far more respectful of the way I used water. For example, there's this whole notion of gray water, where if you just are washing some dishes, they would give you a pan, right, at the bottom. And it's always crazy. You're washing, like, say, 3-4 utensils, and the pan already fills up. And you use that to flush your toilet. And that gray water is what constitutes as the majority waste, right, in our household usage. That really made me quite alarmed at how casually we just, you know, use water without thinking.
I remain perplexed that desalination is not being adopted around the world. As disasters like that in Cape Town play out, accompanied by hand-wringing the world over about dwindling supplies of fresh water, the technology to desalinate seawater at scale already exists. In fact, Israel is a pioneer in this technology. As early as 2013, their Sorek desalination plant in the Mediterranean Sea was online, which, according to a David Talbot article in the MIT Technology Review, by 2015 was able to provide 20% of the water consumed by the country's households. The oceans are essentially an endless supply of water. It just needs to be processed, and the technology exists to process it. Since 2013, the technologies have actually improved and will continue to. Why global water shortages get so much press while potential public works projects to counteract them get ignored is perplexing. As is often the case, it will probably take death and suffering from our most vulnerable global populations before something actually gets done. Let's move on to some of Payal's experiences in Brazil.
Brazil is really a gifted and gorgeous country. You feel very disarmed because it's absolutely beautiful and looks so harmonious with all its nature, and yet it has one of the highest violence crime rates, you know, in the world. And so in our research, we were trying to delve into how do people look at privacy and when they're using digital media. And clearly some of the favelas, which are low-income settlements, were run by drug lords and gangs of all kinds who would force you to be on Facebook. So these communities would be under tremendous pressure to friend everybody in that community, which included these gang members. So they could have a constant watch on what kind of activities you are up to. So in some sense, this sort of publicness of Facebook, including even that of WhatsApp, could be deeply, intrusive based on who is part of it. And so they had a very cautious approach to these digital media technologies, unlike that of Indians, because we were doing a sort of comparative study at the same time, looking at how young Indian people in these slums were using it versus these favelas. And you could tell that privacy was very, very much a concern, including things like geolocation, because what was very common out there was kidnapping and holding people at ransom. So if you knew people were roaming around at a particular time, it can put them in a very vulnerable situation. So who knows, they could have got kidnapped or they could have been tracked. If you're close to an ATM, then people would come to you and force you to take money out and hand it over to them. So there were all these strategies that they were very savvy about because of these sort of horror stories being circulated constantly. And so, yes, they were extremely cautious and very careful about their digital media usage.
What an interesting contrast with, yet similarly tragic to, China's use of technology to modern people's behavior. Here, it is the corrupt and criminal local community that you belong to, imposing platforms that are used to not just control you, but even overtly hurt and steal from you. As you listen to this, from a chair, or a bed, or a car, or a treadmill, feel blessed that we are not faced with this reality, a world where our community is controlled by criminals, and overt pain and loss are so imminent and omnipresent. How must that change your personality and lifestyle? How could it also impact your perception of technology? Let's move on to the Middle East.
I've definitely spent a lot of time like in Amman and Lebanon, but my research, particularly drawn from other very interesting studies, for example, in Saudi Arabia, has been about how, like, we're talking about 90% of that population uses digital media. That's crazy. That's such a high percentage. And Saudi Arabia is not necessarily democratic, right? It is really interesting how things have changed. Authoritarian regimes from being so concerned about digital media usage to a point that they want to really shut down the internet, so to speak, have now come to really embrace these technologies. And this is a really telling part, because if you look at, say, Twitter, where 50% of young people are very active in Saudi Arabia, the most popular Twitter accounts are often imams themselves, because there's a lot of competition amongst these religious leaders to get the young people's attention. And given the history of entertainment being sort of banned because you can't listen to music for the longest time. I mean, obviously things are changing in the last year or so because it's supposedly a sign of progress by allowing access to these to forms of entertainment. But for the longest time, right, you could not listen to music, you couldn't watch movies in theaters. So this was a recourse. And so the preachers understood they needed to be entertained. So they repackaged their religious messages in ways which were entertaining and humorous and really captured the audience in ways, because it was it's a thriving, competitive, so-called free marketplace for the imams, for example. So it's absolutely not something one would actually imagine that to be, right? Because we are so, in the West, entrenched in the whole libertarian angle to digital media that what we don't understand is sometimes these are strong forces to really strengthen traditional agencies, institutions, the moral police in many parts of the world.
While the use of social media by religious organizations and leaders is nothing new, the juxtaposition of the repressive social environment in Saudi Arabia with the creative and intense use of social media by imams there is fascinating. To say nothing of the fact that such a significant majority of the people uses social media, there's something McLuhan-esque about the ways in which smartphone-driven internet technologies are driving social change in different and perhaps unpredictable ways in these far-flung places. China adopts it as the ultimate leverage in maintaining social repression, while Saudi Arabia allows it to flow freely in sharp contrast to seemingly more benign technologies such as film and music. The internet is old news to us, but we are still very early days in terms of understanding the story of the internet as it relates to the story of humanity. We are all activated here in the middle of our giant petri dish. What are some things Pyle has gleaned from across cultures?
This is something I noticed across, if I think about a number of these contexts, whether it is Brazil, India, and all these other contexts. One thing they have in common is that they're really seeking to have things at one place. They're seeking for ecosystems because it costs them every time they move from one platform to another because they have extraordinarily limited data and they function on prepaid data plans, not postpaid, right? So every time they click something and it is buffering, it is eating up their data. So Facebook becomes the internet to majority of these countries. Internet's like the air we breathe, right? We have Wi-Fi, we have postpaid plans. We basically are guaranteed a nonstop 24/7 access to the internet through these very simple plans and these sort of infrastructures. So whether I move from my home to my workplace, I am constantly immersed in internet usage. Whereas for them, for the most part, it's prepaid plans. And these prepaid plans come with little data bundles, which, you know, we have to recognize is absolutely ingenious because it was just a decade ago we were talking about the digital divide and we're talking about how people are going to get access to these kinds of digital media. And now things have changed so dramatically thanks to the mobile phone. The mobile phone has been an absolutely fundamental game changer in these contexts because it's allowed it to be accessible for them because they're relatively cheap, but also alongside comes a numerous number of data bundles which recognizes that these people on average get their wages on a daily basis, not a monthly basis like ourselves, right? So because they are paid on a day-by-day basis, that they can afford data top-ups on a day-by-day basis. So these plans are literally designed in that way. And it is wonderful to see the market responsive at last to the so-called high-risk clientele that has been looked upon for decades now.
I've taken data for granted for a long time. I guess in the early days of smartphones here in the United States, data was still gated. It may be still, but the combination of how much I use my phone and the data plan I'm on result in my never piercing the limit. Just imagine how weird it would be if data was limited by wealth. if you needed to conserve your usage because you could not otherwise afford to continue. In a professional world of Dropbox and Google Drive, that is an almost impossible exercise, but maybe in your personal life. What if the limit wasn't a conviction to use less technology or do something else by choice, but instead that money was the rate limiting factor? What consequences would that have on your sense of self and place in society? Next, how is automation impacting some of these emerging markets?
Automation has a very powerful effect and is being instrumentalized by the state, whether it is India, China, in Kenya, actually around these developing countries. The states have woken up to understanding that if they want to create some kind of harmony in their countries, they need to do some kind of basic functional governance. And in order to govern, particularly massive populations who don't even have any form of ID, no kind of identity card, majority of them have no passports, and all they've been using are their fingerprints possibly to get access to critical services like welfare payments, ration cards for access to food, grain, fuel. Because remember, majority of these economies are welfare economies. It's not marginal like in the West. So that means that what is happening in India and China and these other countries are what they're doing is they're digitizing these identities in ways which are smart, right? They're computing it. So basically look at India with the biometric identity scheme, which is the historically largest scheme in the world, which collects 1.2 billion fingerprints, iris scans, and links that with your background information, your bank information, your social media. And all this provides and reinforces your identity. And there's even talk of using blockchain to really reinforce and make sure that it doesn't get replicated. And so this is sort of because of the lack of a legacy of traditional infrastructures, technical and otherwise, as we have in the West, they're not building upon old systems. They're pioneering entirely new systems, which means what? They are way ahead of the game than us because we don't have anything even closely resembling these kinds of mega identity systems. And this comes with a host of benefits as well as some serious levels of threat, all based on the kinds of regulation you have in place. So, of course, the fact that people can at last access these welfare goods and services to keep them to survive, basically to enable their children to survive, is no small feat, and we cannot undermine that. It is a real amazing innovation and a major feat in the right direction. On the other hand, these sort of hyper-centralized databases and computational power require and demand real security because these are like honeypots for hackers. And if your identity is hacked, you can be even more vulnerable than ever before. So this comes with tremendous amounts of responsibility by these states, and we already are seeing the state failing in this regard due to sometimes arrogance, due to sometimes these sort of lack of coordination. There's a whole host of features, but the fact remains is it is a double-edged sword. And these communities are going to be influenced in both the positive and the negative as regulations get to be tweaked and turned, hopefully in their favor and not against.
It sure gets complicated quickly, doesn't it? While the comprehensive nature of what India is doing seems, and maybe is, unnecessarily intrusive. I do remember as an elementary school student back in the 1980s, members of the local police department came in and fingerprinted the entire lot of us third or fourth graders. They may have even identified our blood type as well as other identifying information. This was before DNA and iris scans were even a thing. And you can be sure that this was not being done to connect us with welfare goods and services. This does not diminish the comprehensive nature of what is being done in other places today, nor the honeypot risk that Pyle pointed out. There's just a lot to unpack and think about, even here closer to home. What are Pyle's thoughts on opportunities for AI in developing nations?
AI can be very useful in ways of reimagining how these communities can lift themselves out of poverty. Anyone who is in the sort of so-called development game is really trying to pioneer new kinds of platforms to compensate for the fact that, for example, majority of villages in developing countries have no doctors. So how can AI come about and sort of behave like a doctor by, based on the sort of prompts for your symptoms, it can suggest the kind of diagnosis and treatment, for example. Actually, I worked on a project very similar to that. Also, in terms of education, the fact that there's high teacher absenteeism or low quality education, often teachers do not teach well because they themselves don't have the kind of education required to impart to these children. Does that mean that it's going to be a constant spiraling downwards? Or can these children, the next generation, leapfrog with the help of AI-based technologies? And so there are innovations and how to enable children to learn with these technologies in ways which can gamify education on these smartphones, considering that there's about 100% penetration rate of smartphones, and of regular phones, and growingly of smartphones, thanks to Jio, for example, which is a new phone system and ecology by the billionaire Ambani in India, who's really the head of Reliance. So on one hand, I'm very optimistic because I understand that we cannot afford to allow another generation to lose out on basics like healthcare, education. It may take generations to address actual access to doctors and quality education and all these other lists. On the other hand, I am very cautious about overestimating its influence. So that's why I feel that we should stop thinking about them as automated technologies and more as assistive technologies, because you cannot get rid of the human element, and nor should we. We need communities to be critical facilitators and enablers of these technologies, because people cannot be completely self-reliant on that. It's not also a compensation for that. Would we say that, okay, our child does not need a school because the child has a great app? We'd never, in our wildest dreams, suggest that. So we should be fair and not suggest the same for them.
Themes that Payal touches on here are consistent with themes shared by other guests whose perspective is more first world, healthcare, education, and the importance of humans in the AI-enabled ecosystem. To finish up, how does Payal think automation can make a better world for all of us?
I think that we need to understand that automation is not a dirty word in some ways, because it's basically trying to get rid of the human element in ways which are toxic, right? I mean, in the best version of it, it's these routinized, repetitive tasks that we definitely do not desire. And that is fine when it gets digitized, it gets mechanized. We need to also understand that we can only celebrate automation when we have strong safety nets, strong security systems that allow us to reimagine our ways of living. So, for example, the universal basic income is one kind of way of imagining what can happen if we allow automation to take place. Yes, maybe it takes away some jobs, but can then we have more time for leisure, for self-actualization, and for social interaction, to have time with our families? So there are those aspects, but that requires a simultaneous reform of institutions, which means to also reimagine even our typical work week. Already some companies are doing that in terms of experimenting on a four-day work week, for example, because productivity is changing in ways which makes us question that, why do we have a five-day work week, even sometimes six-day work week and one-day holiday, for example? Where did that even come about? Because remember, this was created by us as a society in a way to organize our social life. So I think it's about time to leverage on automation to reorganize our social life, to create more time for us to really be creative, to indulge in pushing our intellectual abilities and our empathetic abilities in ways that could really push the global common good.
Thanks again to our guest, Payal Arora. So, John, how did our interview with Payal impact your thinking about the work we are doing with Creative Next?
So I thought it was completely fascinating as she was talking about AI being used as a doctor or a teacher in developing areas, not as a reference for an existing trained doctor or teacher, but really as a resource that would be leveraged by someone who was, you know, an amateur, right? So, you know, enabling, say, you know, for the sake of argument, an IBM Watson that would help you or I sort of run a clinic or, you know, the equivalent. And I think that is a use case that I had just not foreseen, but really makes a lot of sense, which is you don't have these trained individuals necessarily accessible in you know that area. So how are you going to up-level health practice if you can't get the people? Well, you can have people there who have some training who are then really reliant on the AI for more of the technical expertise and making a diagnosis, et cetera. I think that's almost, you know, flipping the thesis of the AI as assistant on its head, right? So in some ways, the human is the assistant to the AI in that case. And I think that that's a super powerful way to think about it. So it's a collaborative process, and the person's going to be learning mm-hmm. health practice or medical practice as they're doing this from the AI doing the diagnosis, et cetera. And that's this idea of the centaur, right? The hybrid, the collaboration between human and AI can be realized in multiple different ways, and probably in the same number of ways that a human to human collaboration can be imagined. And so I think that's a really sort of revolutionary addition to that thesis, because it's not a simple standard relationship. Mm-hmm. There are going to be a variety of relationships that people have with artificial intelligence in collaboration.
That's true. Payal takes for granted that humane social systems need to be figured out before automation seriously changes the landscape of our work and professional opportunity. I hadn't really thought about it that way. That the humane social systems need to come first, in part because that is not how we've collectively been taught to think about it. Thanks to capitalism and or technology, we displace and disrupt people and then either react to it or not. So that Payal puts the social solution in the front as the starting point is certainly an inspiration for me in my life, in this project, to reorder things and be clear that that's the correct way, that the reality that we're living through, that we've been socialized into, isn't how we should be acting and operating. You know, I think that our default mindset needs to change, and mine certainly is.
Yeah, that's going to be a tough one. So with every time you create an AI system that incorporates rules with hidden bias, you're just you're going to wind up with a mess. I mean, we've seen that with projects already around granting early parole from prison systems, just baking in system biases so that, you know, people who may deserve parole don't get it, right? For a variety of reasons. And so if you think about all of both written and unwritten rules that run our sort of interconnected systems, whether they're political or justice systems or economic systems, it's almost like you need an ethics audit of the unwritten rules that needs to happen first. And I really do think that ethics as a practice, as a design practice, is really sort of nascent right now, but it's going to be critical to the development of AI systems that can actually help people, as opposed to just baking in the pre-existing biases. It's kind of a frightening prospect, because I don't see a lot of motivation to incorporate that kind of ethical design into a corporate environment. Like, I don't see the economic incentive, if there will ever be one. So that's a frightening thought, I think.
So what did Pyle say that was the biggest surprise or new kernel of knowledge for you?
Yeah, I think, and you touched on this earlier, but the prevalence of usage of, digital tracking and registration and monitoring by authoritarian states. I think I have a rudimentary knowledge that these things are happening, but the degree to which they seem to have already been implemented is something new to me, and something a little bit worrisome, which, once again, I'm not not looking to send us off in a direction of doom and gloom, but that's what I took away from it. Like, oh, these are much farther along.
Yeah, that was my biggest surprise as well. And it's horrifying, particularly, again, according to the one article, the sort of planned punishments in China that they have for people, such as restricting access to jobs, restricting access to schools for children, taking away pets. I mean, that is out of science fiction, man. Like, the truth is stranger than fiction. Part of me still doesn't believe it. It's like, this can't be right. Really sobering.
Yeah, it's the dystopian novel is now the news.
So what did you learn from Pyle that has influenced your life and how you're living today?
I think keeping in mind the vast variety of human experiences is something that I don't usually do, but is worth reflecting on as we sort of go through our day-to-day routine. I'm not exposed to, a wide variety of experiences in that, we're in Boston, we're in tech. It's, it's easy to keep your head down and just focus on those things. But there is a sort of broad array of not only technical experiences, but also just a wide variety of lifestyles that are, vastly different from ours. And I think that's, it's just a helpful reminder to say, like, hey, look, we're doing quite well. Let's not think only of our own experience.
Yeah, I mean, it's a similar vein for me. I just feel blessed. I feel so lucky to have what I do. I mean, each of her different anecdotes really reinforced that in me. I mean, from the oppression of teens in China, the giant hammer of the Chinese state, which we've spoken about at some length, Brazilian gangsters forcing people onto Facebook so they can be tracked, the water situation in South Africa, and the obvious economic inequalities and sort of lingering apartheid impacts. I mean, I'm thankful to be where I am, have what I have. And it's a reminder that the United States is such a powerful idea. From the inside, I think that we don't realize it. We're not fully in touch with it until we see the realities in other places that people are having to deal with. I mean, even those who have a below average quality of life here, people who here in the United States rightfully feel oppressed or like they're getting the worst share of it, they're in a significantly better position than some of the people in these situations that we've talked about today. That's incredible. It's really eye-opening. We have a great privilege here in general, and I'll even personalize it. I mean, I have a tremendous amount of privilege that I think I often don't realize. And hearing these stories from around the globe really made that hit home in a different way. I feel very blessed, John. So each episode we finish up with a thing to think about, one question germane to what's been covered on the show today. This episode's thing to think about is, what is your perspective on digital identity? Do you favor a more encompassing and utilitarian approach, such as that taken by India, or the relatively unintrusive model in places like here in the United States? And why? Think about that for yourself, and feel free to tweet at us about it at GoCreativeNext. Creative Next is a proud member of Civil, a community-owned platform for independent journalism. Learn more at civil.co, that's civil.co. We are sponsored by GoInvo, a design practice dedicated to innovation in healthcare, whose clients are as varied as AstraZeneca, 3M Health Information Services, and the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Learn more at goinvo.com. We're also sponsored by Design Museum Foundation, a new kind of museum. They believe design can change the world. They're online, nomadic, and focused on making design accessible to everyone. Their mission? Bring the transformative power of design everywhere. You can learn about their exhibitions, events, magazine, and more at designmuseumfoundation.org. Our final sponsor is BIF. As a purpose-driven firm, BIF is committed to bringing design strategies where it is needed most, healthcare, education, and public service, to create value for our most vulnerable populations. To learn more and connect with them, visit at BIF.is, that's BIF.is. Please subscribe to Creative Next on Apple Podcasts. You can also find us at Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you like to listen. You can get in touch with us at the Creative Next website, creativenext.org, or follow us on Twitter at GoCreativeNext. On Medium, we are partnered with Towards Data Science, where we publish articles to extend and build upon these episodes. Check out all that Towards Data Science has to offer at towardsdatascience.com. I'm Dirk Niemeyer, whom you can reach at DNiemeyer, and my partner in crime is Jonathan Follett, who is at John Follett. Thanks to our guest Pyle Arora, who is on Twitter at 3LMantra. Tweet to us with questions, comments, topics, guest suggestions, and include the hashtag CreativeNext. And the home base for everything we do is at creativenext.org. We recommend you sign up for our low-volume newsletter there. That's it for Creative Next Season 2, Episode 11. But here's a clip of what you can expect to hear next time. We'll see you then.
When machines and AI are creating art and music, how do we think about credit? Like, how do we think about copyright?